we kind of got a nice post going up on the Mask of God. I was really impressed by how far the Kubrick post developed.
Kubrick. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Good morning. Top of the morning to you.
Hello. I heard, I saw you guys commenting back and forth in that Facebook message about a new post at Mask of God. Is it still in draft, or?
It has been developing over the last 3 or 4 days. I wanted to post it earlier,
yeah.
But I kind of pulled back from that because I wanted to not get too excited too quickly. So, and David and Jason have just, I don't know how much time they spent, but it's been very impressive, the content that has flowed into it.
Yeah, I just was able to take a quick peek, and I looked at Mask of God, so I saw what had been added to the Kubrick post, but I didn't see the new post you were talking about. I assume it was still in draft, and I just didn't have time to look at it yet.
It's coming together quite nicely. I'm liking it.
So who, I also just coming back from this trip and seeing some things, who's the Kennedy that just died?
Oh, I didn't hear about that.
She was young. She's about 52. I can't place the name off the top of my head.
The question is, did they have dinner with Roman Polanski the night before? You know about that? I found that out actually on 42 Minutes. I hadn't realized that both Bobby and John Kennedy had dinner with Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski the nights before they died. So, like, their last supper was with Roman Polanski for some fucking weird-ass reason. So.
That's pretty... Damn. Okay.
Yeah. I didn't know what to do with that. I feel like if I type in Kennedy dead, I'm going to get so much... Oh, there is... News for Kennedy dead. Cheated on a troubled wife. Mary Kennedy dead?
Yeah.
She hung herself?
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s wife dies at 52. Wow. Mary.
Why is it Kennedy hanging herself?
She killed herself. Is that what you're saying? God.
Hanging in a barn behind the family's home.
She's probably just a dead Kennedys fan, and it was like a tribute. You
know? Or maybe she really liked INXS.
sources tell TMZ 50-year-old woman, old Mary Kennedy, was found dead in her Mount Kisco, New York home this afternoon. The Bedford Police Department responded to the scene to investigate possible unattended death, meaning the death was not witnessed by anyone.
Except for the guy who hung her.
Okay. I'm not seeing any explanation for her. This news isn't saying... They don't usually tell you right away, you know, what the deal is. They just kind of tell you they're dead and that, you know, they're not sure or whatever.
Well, she was just married to a Kennedy. She wasn't really a Kennedy.
Well, you know.
Her name is Mary, though.
She was married to him. And they cut themselves and they exchanged blood. So, you know, that was how... It was a satanic marriage, so they're really together for eternity. Mm. You know, that's the thing with Jim Morrison's wedding. They cut their hands, you know, to do the blood thing, because it's a satanic marriage.
The witch and, one?
Yeah. And he passed out because he couldn't deal with it. The blood, side of blood. Couldn't handle it.
And he woke up pregnant with Rosemary's Baby.
My mom read the book Rosemary's Baby, and she has been telling me since I was young that I need to read it, because she was like, it's amazing. So she was like, you know, really disappointed when she went to go see the movie because they didn't go near what the book was. She did the same thing with Exorcist. My mom's a huge horror movie fanatic, but I was considering reading the book. She even got it again like a couple years ago and was trying to pick it up again, and then she read it when she was like a teenager.
The story I always got from the 70s that I carried with me ever since I heard it when I was about 10 years old was my mother had a friend who, after seeing the movie The Exorcist in the theaters, had to go to therapy. It just, she had a mental breakdown, as the story is told, because of the movie. You know, who knows what the hell was going on in her life, which triggered the breakdown. But it always made me fascinated with wanting to eventually see that film. Obviously, it didn't have quite the resonance with my 13-year-old brain, but well, it's nice to know that 70s movies had that power.
The author has interesting connections to the CIA. William Blatty. If you just, you know, you do a quick Google search of William Blatty, CIA, you'll pull up some interesting things. So there's always a really interesting sort of conspiratorial subcurrent to that movie of people thinking this is either a veiled reference to the church abusing young women, or perhaps the idea of how there's this sort of government-funded concept of the paranormal, you know, sort of demonizing the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a
stay away from that.
Right. Hey, that's our business. You stay away from it.
Yep.
But I just want to go back from Mary Kennedy. I mean, ultimately, the idea of, you know, Rosemary's Baby, Mary being the Virgin Mother, and even, you know, Jackie O and her, this weird idea of, you know, her as Isis and JFK as Osiris. This idea that, you know, besides the obvious, he was the king kill victim, where Jackie O ended up later in life editing a book called, you know, like Osiris and Isis, or the myth of Isis and Osiris. And
wait a minute, Jackie O published a book called
She didn't write it. She was an editor for the book.
Hmm.
So there was someone who wrote a biography on Jackie O, and he makes mention of this book and says, like, in speaking to her, she was fascinated with this myth, and that, you know, he saw it as the very obvious, here's Isis sort of picking up the pieces of the dead husband's body, and here she is with, you know, he doesn't say it in such blunt terms, but both, you know, he makes it more symbolic of picking up the pieces of this broken life, but obviously her having his body parts sprayed all over her, and you know, you could take it as a more literal thing that she was very much a witness to this ritualistic killing.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think, like, for me, it's really fascinating that not only did she edit a book about Isis and Osiris, but then she was instrumental in, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there is the Temple of Dendur, this old sort of Hathor temple, Hathor Isis temple, and Jackie O lived across the street from it. So this exhibit gets put in, this temple to Hathor Isis gets put in across the street from Jackie years later. So here she's, you know, front row seat to the king kill, then she has the Temple of Isis put across the street from her, and then and she actually worked in saving the exhibit. She wanted it put in D.C. as a tribute to JFK, which is just really interesting in itself. So she wanted this ISIS temple to be saved as a memory, put in, I mean, moved to D.C. as a memorial to JFK. And then she edits a book about Osiris and ISIS, her biographer saying that she was fascinated with this myth. It seems like she, at least on some level, really understood what archetypal role she was in.
Wow, that's I definitely incorporated and went into that in the draft that we're working on in relationship to Hedwig and the Angry Inch. So, have you guys ever seen Hedwig and the Angry Inch?
Yeah.
I have not.
So, you know, the Origin of Love song in it basically came out of Plato's Symposium, which is the idea that it originally were two in one people, you know, were both at once, which is like the Adam. You know, the concept of the Adam is that we were, God created us, man and woman, but we're one until we get split. So we're, you know, it's this whole thing. If you actually look in the Hebrew that, and you take it literally, that's what it has to say. And so, yeah, I was looking at the thing in the film that he gets upset with his friend Tommy for changing the lyric of Osiris to Cyrus. And then the guy, he's like, Osiris is a god. And he's like, no, Osiris is a god. It's an Egyptian god. You know, and he's like, we had two versions of that song. And he's like, no, we had one. It was like this whole argument. But then I'm looking up Cyrus, you know, and I'm like, Cyrus sounds familiar. I mean, what is that? And it's this emperor, and I should have known this. I forgot, from the Old Testament. And you know, he's a real emperor who fucking took. He was basically the first emperor to introduce like human rights in a way that hadn't been introduced before. And he referred to the Jews as the Messiah. And was like really exceptional in all these different ways. It's kind of far out, but he was likened to the sun, and his name actually literally means like the sun. So Cyrus means like the sun, and then, you know, Osiris is the moon, and he's the most common version of it is that he's broken up into 13 pieces to represent the 13 you know, moons of the year. And so I was going into it, and then how Osiris is the whole thing with his severed penis. And then if you watch Hedwig and the Angry Inch, it's this, you know, like you can see what the identification is and why it means so much to the character in that regard. So, and then also that in the special features, they liken Hedwig's wig to the ring of Lord of the Rings. And the way everyone's wearing these like wigs to represent him in the film, you know, basically those wigs are like rings. So I was just tripping out on it. I incorporated it.
Yeah, now the whole idea of the transvestite, I see where you're going with the Osiris and the severed phallus. But there's also, I mean, to me, ultimately, this is, as you said, the idea of starting as one gender and splitting into two. Then this is why we have to go to the alchemical marriage and sort of reunite the male and female principles.
Well, that's, so with Jason's work, he keeps looking at pushing Lolita as the Shakina, right? And Shakina is one with Ze'er. They're one being in the first place, and they get broken up. And then that becomes Malkut and Tiferet, right? So it's a split.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's significant because he's like Lolita, but then Lolita is Lola. So like the kink's Lola.
Oh, yeah.
I was just tripping out on that.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that, I mean, in, you know, human biology, every one of us starts as, actually starts as a woman in the womb, you know, as we're sort of gestating, and then we turn male. You know, sort of like at some point you're neither sex, and then at some point you're female, and then at some point you're male, if you end up, you know, becoming a male. So totally. It's the same idea of like starting as one, and then you have that sort of split off. So I love the idea of trying to reclaim it, particularly for men. And I think it's interesting that so many of the people interested in this work are men. you know, not exclusively, right. but certainly it seems to be the majority. And I wonder if it's
right.
not this idea of trying to sort of reclaim or, you know, reacquaint ourselves with that feminine principle.
Right. So the other part of that was that it's the Adam is both male and female, right? We split the atom. So, like, to create the nuclear bomb. So
yeah.
I was tripping out on that, you know. Marilyn Manson lyric, the Adam of Eden was a bomb. In Hollywood, and so I don't know. I was considering all the implications of that in relationship to Kubrick, specifically in Full Metal Jacket when he puts "I am become death" on the character Animal Mother's helmet, and then I think Animal Mother immediately. I thought of this actually a few years ago. Adam Hart Mother, so Animal Mother, Adam Hart Mother. It's Adam. You know, like an atom bomb, Adam.
Right.
And it's a cow on the covers. It's this image of a cow. And then I'm looking at the whole thing with milk that keeps coming up with Kubrick. And then also that he gets his fucking, in A Clockwork Orange, the name of the woman who they go under to get the milk from her tit, you know, is Lucy. He goes, "Hey, Lucy." And I keep thinking Lucy in the sky with diamonds, and she's wearing fucking diamonds, you know, and Lucy in the sky with diamonds is obviously LSD. And I keep looking at these correspondences. It's Oppenheimer who said, "I am become death," which is a quote from the Bhagavad Gita when the first nuclear bomb went off. So Oppenheimer is involved in the Moonchild ritual, the Babylon working with Crowley and Jack Parsons. So, what the fuck?
Yeah, and you and I have come back to again and again this idea of the atomic bomb explosion and LSD being sort of two sides of the exact same emergent force, if we can call it that. This sort of breaking open, you know, just break on through to the other side. It's like the same time we're splitting the atom, we're also blowing our minds with LSD. These two things come about at almost the same time. So I very much can see that connection to that, the splitting atom, and if she is Lucy, as in Lucy in the sky with diamonds, this being, again, that showing that two sides of the same thing.
Right.
Something, I just had an experience yesterday. I was coming back to New York, and I'm on this long bus ride, and it was so funny because I was actually thinking about all this stuff. And then I look out the window, there's a company called Crowley, a milk company called Crowley. So it's Crowley's
with
milk.
With an O?
What's that?
With an O?
I believe so.
Is it called Crowley? Yeah.
So the there, but there's a milk company. So we keep coming to this idea of milk.
It's perfect.
So I had seen, so basically I look out the window and I see this truck pass by, and I'm assuming it looked like it was the same logo. I don't know if that's all they do is make dairy products or not, but I see the Crowley truck, and then I look up and there's a billboard. It was so funny because the whole, like, what I'm sitting there thinking about is the lightning flash and all this stuff, and I look up and there's a billboard. I'm in Baltimore, and there's this billboard for a casino, and what do they have but an image of the slot machine with the big 777, you know, big bright red flaming letters, 777, and it says for, it actually was Hollywood Casino, so there's your Hollywood, but it's Hollywood Casino, and it says exit 93.
Nah.
So I see the giant 777. If you want to go to the 777 casino, you get off at exit 93, and I just thought, I look back at the Crowley truck, good. Look back at the billboard, and I'm like, get the hell out of here.
Totally. Yeah, yesterday we watched the ending of Harold and Maude, and which I had seen when I was really young. But anyways, get to the end scene, and I had been working yesterday in Photoshop on this piece that's basically an eye, and I wanted to put the Play Loud apple from Instant Karma. So if you got the record, Instant Karma, which is We All Shine On, right, which is The Shining, and the apple inside says Play Loud. It's the Beatles apple, you know. And basically I put that on this eye, and then beneath it I have instant karma, and then kind of fading around it is this image from the garden with the serpent doubled and Adam and Eve doubled, basically looking towards the middle. And anyways, I do this whole thing, and then Harold and Maude, right before they die, right before they get fucking shot down, Maude bites into this big green apple, like, moments before, and it's all like, oh! and shortly before that, when the cops first show up and they have to leave the town, the license plate said 777. And it's just, you know, whatever. I was just like, it just increased the whole awareness of the situation with the combination of those two things with what I've been looking at, you know. So, anyways, it's kind of funny.
Bill, you're very quiet today. What's going on in your head?
Oh, you guys are just racing. I'm just trying to listen. You know, there's some of the movies you're talking about I haven't seen, so I can't really interject, but just taking notes right now.
So tell me more about this post that you guys started. I mean, I know one of the things, well, or maybe we can get there. One of the things I know we wanted to talk about was this idea of the magic squares. And it was funny because at first I didn't even make the connection when I sort of, just the idea of stacking the Kubrick posters for that Mask of God post, and then I realized, of course, he's the cube brick. It's like stacking Legos one on top of the other. You know, you're stacking bricks. Another brick in the wall, of course. So then I, you know, to see this idea come up with the magic squares, I saw, Bill, that you put up a story just this week. There was the world's largest Lego tower was constructed.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was really? Just,
putting the image of the Legos in a post of mine and then, you know, connecting this whole breaking down of the light of Logos in our world into its smallest parts so that you can rebuild it again. And the whole idea of, you know, the Torah, you can always reboot to the beginning because it's all consonants and you breathe the vowels of life into it to bring meaning. And with all that running around, you know, the kids break a record by building a literal tower of Logos. It was kind of astounding.
And of course, this is your Tower of Babel, right? This is where, if the Logos is the word, in the beginning there was the word, the Logos. What are we doing with our Tower of Babel? Is where is our Tower of Speech? So we're rebuilding our sort of cosmic antenna where we're getting, you know, our radio receiver for the Logos. But I had actually, what's funny to me is I had done in the Squares That Touch comic, I had actually have a little girl build a Lego tower, which is supposed to be in the comic. It's supposed to be the monolith from Space Odyssey. So for me, the Lego tower, I like, just on a personal level, I can't help but equate with the monolith.
So this is funny. Last night I bought a book on Kubrick, something like the Mazes of the Artist or whatever. It's like got Kubrick's face and it's got a maze built around it. And I got it at a store called Logos. That's the name of the store in town. So it's kind of funny. I've been tripping out on expansion and division being two sides of the same thing, which is basic in physics. You know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. But in this case, it has to be acknowledged that they're simultaneous in this regard. So if cells divide, they divide to multiply. So through their division, you end up with an expansion. And so I keep coming back to the bomb being splitting of the atom, and that we refer to LSD as expanding the mind. We're like, oh, expand your mind. And so I also think of the Tower of Babel as everyone's divided through basically the speech. Originally, everything's one language, and then everything breaks apart. That's why it's good to call it Babylon, baby, like, because basically we all become as children, you know, with our language. We like have to relearn everything. But then it's through that division that everyone expands across the globe. So that's, you know, in whatever you want to call it, you know, the myth or whatever, you know, it makes perfect sense in that regard of physics, you know.
Sure, it's a temporary confusion, but it also urges a sort of evolutionary push. It allows us to complexify. You know, we go from a simple binary to something more complex. It's like, all right, everyone speaks one language, now sort of go forth and multiply, speak different things. And I think that, again, there's two sides to the same coin. Something that I always come back to is that idea of this expansion. I think it's interesting that you're saying it's the same thing at once. It's actually a fascinating concept for me, but there's another side of that is I had had this psychedelic vision once of the universe with the Big Bang. You know, you sort of have your Big Bang as your expansion outward, and then you sort of have your collapse back, and then it would just sort of repeat. And something I learned shortly after that, I saw this documentary about how children develop in the womb, and it says once those cells divide to a certain point, what they start doing is convulsing outward, inward, outward, inward, and this is the formation of the beating heart. So it's one of the first steps after cell division. One of the first steps is expand and contract, expand and contract. So to me, this is a perfect idea of a similar thing as I've always thought of being truly in sync. You know, we found that we can sync ourselves with anything, but if we truly want to be in sync with sort of what I call the heartbeat of the universe, it would be that very basic expansion and contraction cycle, and that, you know, right now we might be on an expansion mode universally, but then there's times to, again, this is ebb and flow. This seems to be, to me, seems like basic rule of nature, but instead of thinking it as like a beginning and an end, it's sort of that. What you're saying, this symbolic, that it's both at once, is that these are both necessary.
Well, the two are so intermeshed that it's hard to differentiate. You know, as far as simultaneous goes, I mean, just in terms of the law of compensation and how quickly that does what it does. So that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The only reason why I'm stressing the in the midst point is because there was this really strange idea that was actually brought forth by Einstein that we're an expanding universe and eventually everything's going to have to contract. And for me, I'm like, I'm no fucking Einstein, obviously, but the whole notion that that we're not contracting simultaneously feels so absurd. We exist in a vacuum. Like, I don't know much, but I know that, you know, it's like the thing is contracting right now, always already in the midst of the expansion. And so, you know, just in terms of the greater picture, the foundation of it all is doing that. So it's just, I don't know about this like long-term expansion and then long-term contraction business. I mean, you could say that on a certain level, but it seems like it's already happening. So I don't know.
Well, does this tie into the whole notion that the Big Bang and then the proposed Big Crunch are really the same occurrence, but they just are perceived differently depending on how you approach them?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I've always associated the Big Crunch to crunch time, as in like athletics, and how it's amazing how even the most incredible athletes, when it comes to crunch time, can behave in very, very anomalous ways. Some people rise to the occasion and perform the unbelievable, and some people don't rise to the occasion and choke and are labeled the GOAT. And it's
Did you say labeled the GOAT?
Well, you know.
That's perfect.
you know, who's the GOAT? You know, who's the one who choked? Who's the one who dropped the ball in the ninth inning? So, and the whole idea, the whole idea of the crunch time is, granted, it's near the end of the game, so physically you're a little bit more worn down and you don't have as much physical strength to draw upon. But ultimately, the idea of crunch time is only in your brain. And you have complete control over how you react to that approaching moment where, you know, athletically, the game is going to end. So I think you find that with on all levels outside of, you know, a basketball court or a golf course. I mean, it that kind of psychology probably is best evidenced in crowds, where crowds, as they approach seemingly momentous events, can react differently. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I think that the way America reacted to 9/11 as a big crunch, the aftermath, I think, could have been a lot worse. Now, granted, I don't live on the other side of the ocean, but as far as what happened during World War II with you know, containment camps and violence, it seems to me that the crowd of the world, as bad as we complain about the way things are going, don't you kind of imagine that it could have been so much worse?
I have very strong and mixed emotions about that. So, I want to briefly comment just to say, when you say, again, comparing this idea of the big crunch and the expansion, I liked that you brought
could
up
you
the crowd.
Could you speak up a little bit, Alan?
What's that?
I'm sorry. What? Could you speak up a little bit?
Oh, sure, yeah.
I keep kind of, yeah.
Let me see, make sure my, yeah, okay. Basically, what I was trying to get at is in the expansion and crunch concept, and you even brought this to crowds. I liked that you brought it to crowds because something that we played with last summer was the idea that perhaps, you know, this emerging singularity, you know, people talk this singularity, and then there's this, on one side, people fear it as like some sort of Borg-like thing. And at the same time, what it seems like is the internet and this technology, although it has brought us together, and in some cases, I mean, we can see that people have become really zombified and really Borg-like. So there is an emergence of that. But at the same time, what I do see also is that we can have conversations like this where we all bring it together, but what we're bringing together is our individuality and, you know, the sort of the sum of the parts is only one component. So I'm very comfortable with this paradox of everything sort of coming to a head, some sort of convergence, but at the same time, it is spawning something vastly new and multifaceted. So with crowds, very often, you know, you get into this like mob mentality. I know that there is a possibility for that, but there's also the idea of bringing together something that's completely multifaceted and not, you know, some homogenized Borg-like consciousness. So I like the idea of the paradox that it seems that both are possible at the same time. And I think I'll refrain from commenting on America's response to 9/11 for the moment.
So, the first thing I thought of this morning, oddly enough, which I'm holding in my hand just to double check, and I need to think, is, are the 18th letter of the alphabet?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So, this whole R&R thing, immediately I'm like, 18, why 18? I think the moon. The moon is the reflection, right? Moon is a mirror for the sun. It's not my own light that I'm showing you, you know? The moon card in tarot pictures two towers, even in the Marseille tarot. Yet the death card pictures the same two towers in the Rider deck and in the Crowley deck. you can see the two towers. I should say Lady Frieda Harris deck. But I don't know. It was just a whole thing that just occurred to me. It kind of just snapped, and I was like, huh. Like, you know, the moon would be doubled in a sense. That's the whole thing with the phases of the moon, the cycles of the moon. It kind of like, you know, it's perfect. So I immediately flashed to the Jim Morrison quote where he says the moon is a dry blood beast, and how in the Lady Frieda Harris deck, you can see the blood with the scarab or the beetle, you know, in the center. And coming down, you know, and so, and I don't know. It was just, it was something that came up that I was kind of like had to tilt my head at, because I've been looking at, you know, the whole 13 thing. Jim Morrison's last album while he was alive was called 13, and Death, and that Death, you know, pictures the Pope with the Dogon tribe fish god thing on his head, and then the Rosicrucian rose in white up there on Death's flag in the rider deck, you know, and how odd that is with like the towers behind have always like, I've never quite known exactly what to make of those. I also visualize like the never ending story with the two sphinxes. Like it's this thing you have to cross to get to the other side or something, like they're like watchtowers or whatever. But anyways, I just thought I'd put that out there because it was like while I was half awake and just coming to, that was like just came to me and I was like, huh, weird.
Well, think of it this way. On the Death card, so you actually, at the foot of Death is the killed king. You do have the Pope there, but at the horse's feet is the slain king. So the victim of the king kill was there. But now I just want you to consider that I like the idea of the moon is the mirror. And we can go back to that Jake Coetzean 9/11 Stargate is like Alice stepping through the looking glass. You know, if it's a mirror, you step through the mirror. Again, this is, you know, sort of seeing the going on to that other side, if you will. But I noticed that on the Death card, what's rising between the two towers is the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So just to say, just make a distinction between those two towers. One has the moon in between the towers, and the other has the sun between the two towers.
Well, it's an eclipse, so the moon stands before the sun, and it's only showing you its one eye.
That's right, and we actually have an eclipse coming up next week on Sunday, I believe.
Yes, at 4 p.m. my time. I don't know what time you're.
See, and this is interesting because I keep having this weird sync with blackouts. And Bill, I realize you even said last week, I was listening to it, you said about the Incredible Hulk and basically that he's a blackout drunk.
That's in my own experience. That's how it feels like to me.
Right, but I get
it's you wake up. Did I hurt anybody? It's not a good feeling.
No, of course. But I'm saying that the phrase blackout drunk. So it's this moment, you know, at the in the Jesus story, at the moment of his crucifixion, there's an eclipse. So again, we have a king kill. And the blackout. So, of course, Jesus is the Son, S-U-N, of God. So the moment the sun is blocked out is the death of that solar king.
Mm-hmm.
So we see how that goes hand in hand. And again, we see it on the Death tarot card. But what I realized, so I had this dream like a week or so ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, that was said, like this voice says to me, stock up on batteries, there's going to be a blackout. Now, I didn't really put much credence into it. It seemed like dream advertising. Like, tell me to buy shit? I'm like, what am I going to do with battery? If it's really that bad, I don't think a flashlight's just going to get me through it. It's not to look a gift horse in the mouth or anything. I'm just saying, like, I sort of thought it was comical in one sense, and at the same time thought it was really interesting. And then that was probably 2 weeks ago, and then suddenly everyone started talking about how there's a an eclipse coming. And then Bill said to me last week about Hulk being a blackout drunk. And this sort of phrase, blackout, or this blotting out of the light, keeps sort of pinging for me really strongly. And I think it's just really, I'm trying to figure out what exactly to make of it. But when you said the eclipse, it reminded me that this is, I don't know, something that's really vibrant for me right now.
Yeah, no, and inside the monolith, you know, the idea that the overture, you know, is becoming immersed in the reality of the monolith, which is a complete blackout. So, you know, I've eaten acid and gone to see that movie in the theater, and like when it's like everything's black, and then they give you that resonant, you know, the music, you know, it's like definitely the idea that you're inside the monolith is like the ultimate blackout in a sense, you know.
It's a cube of some sort, then. You're in the middle of the cube. You're
right.
In...
That's okay. The Kaaba, totally.
The Kaaba, yeah.
Yeah, and it's
to. How do you relate that to... A friend of mine had me watch a scene from Mulholland Drive recently, and the cube makes an appearance in that film.
Oh, yeah. So I take that as that's the Fool, and nobody wants to approach the reality of what the Fool is. And the whole fucking Hollywood echelon had... They're like dangling that there's a secret at the end, but they're looking for it in the wrong direction. And it's the fucking crazy guy behind the dumpster that nobody wants to face the reality of what it actually means to understand the Fool, you know?
So that's the true face of Hollywood or Hollywood.
That's what I see. Yeah. Is that they're all moving in this direction, which is actually like, you know, they're sublimating. And that underneath all the sublimation, there's this, you know, ultimate understanding that transcends the intellect that they don't want to look at because it'd be too humiliating. And so him laughing and her killing herself over it is like it's rubbing it in her face that she's completely off base as far as what she thinks it's supposed to be about, you know.
So when Betty goes to Club Silencio, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she enters into the theater and they tell you everything is a recording. And then we have a double R come out on stage, Rebecca Del Rio. And she starts to sing this song that touches Betty so profoundly that she has sort of an emotional orgasm and shakes and almost seizures through this wave and wave of pure beauty and emotion. And then Rebecca Del Rio collapses and the voice is still there. She had bought it for a second. She had believed, they had told her, this is a lie. But then she had the emotional reaction. And then I think when Del Rio falls to the ground and the voice is still there, it's like, is that the snap out of the spell?
Oh, I need to look that up again, because there's actually like a complete explanation for that that made absolute perfect sense of what's going on in that scene. That was one of the few things that was completely deciphered. Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you seen that? There's like, I can probably find it really quick if I try.
Send it to me later and I'll take a look at it. But it's after that scene that they return to the apartment and the dark-haired one, I forget her name, she goes to the purse and finds the cube and unlocks it, and it's empty. And then you're into the reality of what Betty's life really is.
Well, yeah.
A reality of what Betty's life is.
Right. It's a dream from the very beginning when she ends up in the fucking apartment and falls asleep or whatever, you know. That's at least the argument that makes the most sense for me. You know, I have a hard time. Yeah, it's that fucking movie's a Rubik's Cube in the first place, so... You know, I don't know.
I liked Michael from Gosporn commented on our Kubrick post, and he said something like something about Rubik's Cube or a Kubrick's Cube or something like that. But I liked the idea of like Kubrick's Rube, you know, the Fool, the one who's fooled by the illusion in the theater. You are Kubrick's Rube.
It's perfect. Yeah.
Well, the theater is itself a cube, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
I'll accept that.
when you remove all the veils and get to just the literalist of literalisms, that's the secret of 2001. The monolith is the screen. The theater is the cube. They have you inside of the place that they are showing you. Isn't that what the essence of Artaud's theater and its double? That hallway of mirrors, I'm guessing, that every performer on stage, as they're performing, are witness to a performance on the other side.
It's the mirror. It's mm-hmm. looking. It's stepping through the looking glass.
Okay.
Through a looking glass darkly. Get it. So that came up yesterday. I was talking to my friend, not even thinking about Through the Looking Glass, but saying Paul's quote from the Bible. I believe it was Paul. Through a glass darkly, and that's where A Scanner Darkly came from. You know, he's like, but he's taking it in new terms, saying, do the scanners see us as we are, or do the scanners just see us this kind of veil and take that as us? You know, it's like, not that if these, you know, if we're trying to be omnipotent and see everything from all angles at once and tear off all the roofs, and that's what this whole fucking surveillance ambition is about, is to be able to basically be God. It's all completely skewed. It's not the reality. They're not seeing things as they are. They're seeing it through the scanner darkly. And then I was thinking about Through the Looking Glass and how his whole take on algebra, and you know, that he's basically making fun of where the direction that things are going if you take things literally, you know, which people end up doing, because you can go and just, you're basically taking off all the constrictions in math and just opening the whole fucking thing up. And then he's like, look where you'll end up in Wonderland. You know, and so in a sense, that's another example of, like, you're basically looking through the thing and it's all veiled, and you don't know which is which and who is who anymore. Like, as if you ever really did in the first place, but still, you know. So.
Well, I think it's interesting. We're talking about the dark glass. You know, obviously you have in Donnie Darko, the rabbit opens up a wormhole in the movie screen. So you have, again, like the Alice goes down the rabbit, she goes through the rabbit hole and also through the looking glass. But something that I come back to, I learned when Chris Myers wrote this piece for the Sync book, he has this like few sentences that really stuck with me. It says, spiritualist William Crookes had invented the Crookes tube after scrying in a black mirror as a way to communicate with spirits. Now, besides the Crookes tube leading to the discovery of electrons and later X-rays, it was used to invent the original standard TV. Spiritualist John Logie Bard, born 1888, who invented the television itself, had said in his own book that he was in contact with the spirit of Thomas Edison. So this idea
tied it all together.
Spirits through the black mirror, through the dark glass, leads to the television, which is, of course, the home cube. It's the movie theater brought into a cube in the home.
Uh-huh. It's a cube within the cube. That's fucking perfect. I didn't know that. And so that's the thing with mirrors, is that they were just glass. You know, I mean, they're polished glass, basically. Now they're different, I think. I think you can still get mirrors like that, but... you know, that's strange. Thinking about a television set turned off, that's black thing that's just there, and then it illuminates, you know,
right?
Well, far out. Right.
Now,
well, it's interesting to have grown up in an age where the television itself would turn off, where programming would stop.
Yeah,
to be up late at night and then to just wake up to static. That has to have been an epic leap forward for, you know, media, to where media was on and then it was off. There were breaks, much like I think how our consciousness was at a very early part in our evolution. We were awake and we were totally asleep. But on some level, we're awake in our dreams and we're awake in our reality 24 hours a day, nonstop. And learning how to deal with that river of thought is, you know, is the key to sanity in this world.
I believe we're,
we don't get this.
I believe we're now joined by Jason Barrera. Jason, are you there?
Yes, for the moment I'm here. I don't know how long this will last.
For the moment, right. Jason is trapped on the other side of the scrying glass.
Yes.
We're talking about mirrors and the movie screen as monolith, Donnie Darko. I'm sure anything you could possibly throw at us would be sinky as hell.
Yeah. Well, I was just looking at Full Metal Jacket, where the exiting the movie thing is also a recurrent motif, as is in all of Kubrick's movies. But I'm not sure what you guys have been talking about here.
Where is that in Full Metal Jacket?
There's a movie theater when they're with the prostitute, and the second prostitute with the cream in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in a movie theater. And they're sitting in movie chairs.
What's the film that they're playing there? Do you know? It's like a Western?
It's a John Wayne Western.
Oh.
Of course.
So I'm not sure which one.
Because Private Joker is John Wayne. He says, yeah, right, he does.
Is that you, John Wayne? Is this me?
Yeah. So it's John Wayne's theater. Now, are we talking about John Wayne Gacy or John Wilkes Booth?
I have a draft where all this is explained, but when they get to the theater, they go through the door and exit the movie, which is the same as 2001, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
How do you connect the whole? It sticks out to me that Animal Mother has a line about where he uses the word nigger, right? And mm-hmm. and so does Grady when he's talking in the conversation to Jack. And mm-hmm. that this is a word that sort of is, it signifies understanding of their positions in the world. And, you know, with everything in Kubrick, it's a deliberate choice in the moment. And Animal Mother takes the prostitute into the theater, and he says, "I go first." Right after he had said something about black people being less than white people, and granted, in that sort of soldier speak, it's taken as just humor, dark humor, and a comment just on the horror of their situation. But I'm wondering if that has any relation to a black mirror or a darkness or something.
Well, there's what Freud in The Interpretation of Dreams has to say about if a white person sees a black person in a dream and what that represents for them, and the fear that it brings up is the shadow. Carl Jung ran with that notion of the shadow, which is the basis for Full Metal Jacket, that the enemy you never actually see, that it's actually themselves. It seems like we're shooting the wrong gooks, we're filming the wrong gooks, that we have seen the enemy and it is us. And that the only way that they can continue to destroy the enemy as long as they're destroying themselves. And then that breakdown that they're experiencing within themselves and losing their innocence is basically just that.
Bill pointed out that the Lego Tower we were talking about before was built in Korea. This giant record-setting Lego Tower was built in Korea. Just because Gook is actually... A reference to Koreans, which is where they would say Han Gook means to be Korean. So it's not you know, for Western ears, it's a derogatory term, but it's not. It's sort of based on an actual nationality. So, in when they're using that phrase, even though they're using the phrase in Vietnam, in this movie, of course, they're saying it. It's like in Big Lebowski when the Big Lebowski in the wheelchair, the wounded king, he says something like, "I had my legs blown off by a Chinaman in Korea." You know, it's this sort of like mixed. I think perhaps like an intentional mistaken. Even in the derogatory slang, they're making a mistake of sort of lumping everything together and sort of showing the ignorance, perhaps.
Right.
You know what I mean?
We're going to go to this. I thought I would go visit another country, meet the people, whatever, learn the customs. I forget what the actual quote is. And then, you know, kill them, you know. Like, complete lack of understanding of their culture is necessary in order to just rationalize what you're doing.
Well, just from an emotional standpoint, when I started to bring up the point of the scenes in Full Metal Jacket and The Shining where the word nigger is used, in my body, I could feel myself tense up before I said it. And I knew in my mind, I said, can I use that word? Should I say the N-word? Should I preface it by saying they refer to African-Americans as the N-word? There were all these different pathways I could have taken to communicate what essentially is just in a movie. It shouldn't be a reflection of my character or who people think I am. And it made me think of a word as a brick. And when thrown carelessly can cause great damage. And that, you know, nigger being it's the N-word. It is the king of words that start with N. When you say the N-word, there's only one word you really think of. And it's this whole idea of... this whole thing about Burroughs and what he said he loved most about Scientology was this idea of learning how engrams in your mind can cause dis-ease and can cause discomfort. And that the system of L. Ron Hubbard was to allow the person to confront these engrams embedded in their mind and to reduce their negative associations with it. And since Burroughs had such a deep feeling that language was a virus that had infected the human host and found a permanent home there, this was a profound way for him to find some healing and some insight into that fear. And Stanley Kubrick, you know, the monolith is a black brick. The logos and the wall are made of bricks. I think that this is a key point in when he uses that N-word, everyone can identify with an emotional reaction when they hear that. It might even be the one word that certain people remember most out of a Kubrick film when they hear it. And that's a peculiar construct, maybe just in the Western mind right now, but it is a peculiar symptom that can be diagnosed in humanity in the 20th century. How one word said at the wrong time can start a riot. And that is a power that we wield blindly, and to grasp how to wield that power for good or for evil seems to be everything about our political world, our social world. And if Burroughs found such insight in Scientology, and probably Jung and Freud would agree, and even Wilhelm Reich would agree, that it medically, a word can be a construct of our physical body and lead to health or wealth.
I wonder, you know, if it's this alchemical Kubrick, is it a reference to the Negredo phase of the great work?
Right, and so these are like the egoic figures who are kind of trying to repress that darker side as I need to. Need to look at fully. And fully encounter. I'm sure you know it.
Yeah. The N-word is interesting because nun keeps coming up, the Hebrew letter nun, which corresponds to death and 13. And the fact that we call it the N-word and then Negro is so close to necro from Latin, which is death. Just an interesting side thought. also, it just occurred to me in this conversation that M is the 13th letter of the alphabet. Am I right?
Yes.
I think it is. Okay, and that it's Matthew Modine. So I go into this RR thing with the moon, that the R is the 18th letter of the alphabet. The two towers that occur in the death card occur in the moon card. That's kind of weird. You know, the MM thing, I've been going into that too. So Marilyn Manson, Marilyn Monroe, Master Mason. You know, anyways.
Can I ask you this? What do you think of the idea that, you know, in basic numerology, the idea of where you keep it as cycling from 1 through 9, MK, because I'm looking at your name here, MK Ultrasound, the MK of MK Ultra is 42.
Ah, I never noticed that. That's cool.
I just always think it's funny. It's just a simple, since you were breaking down letters into numbers here, I always thought it's funny that the 42 could be reverse engineered back into an MK.
That's awesome. Huh. And then it's, 723, is 7 times 2 times 3, 42. That's weird. Cool.
Have any of you been following that Kubrick thread over at the David Icke forum?
Can't say that I have, no.
I've been following it, but you knew that.
Yeah, a little bit.
One of the things that jumped out at me was the notes on the Neptunium element. Did any of you catch that?
I caught it. It was a little too crazy for me.
It's a little out there, but as far as a sink, it's just a home run. In that it's the 93rd element on Neptunium.
Oh.
And it's the 93rd element on the table of elements, but its most stable isotope is numbered 237. And so run with that how you want to run with it, but that is a fucking bullseye. Because he relates it to the old woman in the bathtub that Jack confronts as being beautiful, but then she looks like she's been scarred with radiation burns.
Totally. Wow.
So that the whole idea of opening the door to room 237 is the splitting and the opening of the atom. And
right,
you'll get your expansion, but you will also have to pay for that vacuum you create. And that is, you know, okay, so LSD, you drop LSD, you get the expansion, but at higher and higher doses, not only do you sort of filter in the things that you would rather not think about, whether or not, whether it's yourself, whether it's your past, whether it's your family's past, but anyone that has any working knowledge of history and psychology, you open the door to re-examining the history of the world and then the history of civilization. And you start to feel your emotional place in the story that is happening right there in that moment. And it is a very bitter pill to swallow to wake up and find yourself very comfortable, very middle class in the Midwest, and very removed from most of the awful shit that you've read about that seems to be everywhere else in the world. So, you know, nuclear bomb, nuclear psychology, dabbling with the arts, with the alchemical arts, with elements, yeah, it's all connected right there.
I want you to consider the idea that if Doctor Strangelove ends with all these atomic explosions, and Kubrick said that the ending there was meant to be a sort of orgasmic, it's all sexual metaphor, that it's an orgasmic experience. When Jack steps into room 237, he of course sees the young young naked woman with no scars on her, and his intent is to fuck her, presumably, right? He's like, oh my god, yes, and then he goes and he starts to kiss her. But if we take it with that Dr. Strangelove, is so assuming these sort of the coupling, and again, even alchemically, right, that at the moment the king and the queen get into the bathtub together, have sex, and then they die. So Jack meets her in the bathtub, but the moment he kisses her, if we can consider this the moment of union, even though we don't see them actually have sex, the moment they kiss, she suddenly is covered with the radiation burns. I think that's actually a genius connection of, because if Strangelove, those atomic explosions are sexual release. So it's as if him kissing her released that radiation, that atomic explosion, and now she's covered with those radiation burns. I think that's actually really fascinating.
Right. Well, Kubrick is head deep in Freudian psychology, so the death instinct and the pleasure principle are one and the same. So the movement towards climax is also the movement towards death. So, and then he's looking at that not just on a one person's experience level, but on a grand scale about all of us in terms of capitalism. So.
Right. So any of these things, like, you know, he's referencing, you know, Vietnam is a slaughter. In The Shining, it's built on top of a graveyard. So, like, literally, what are you building on top of all this death? So this is why they go to Vietnam and they're meeting the prostitutes. They want to get laid. They want to kill things. It's right when he says, I want to go meet interesting people, learn their culture, and kill them. But they also want to fuck them. So again, we see
this.
So even in The Shining, he's encountering death and sex. In all these movies, it's the same sort of connection where the foundation is the underground dead, the building it on top of a graveyard. And just to...
It's both an Indian graveyard, because the whole thing in Full Metal Jacket is that it's a metaphor for cowboys and Indians.
Right.
In Full Metal Jacket.